abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Wednesday, November 27th, 2013, the very cusp of Thanksgiving. And we are joined today by economist Robert P. Murphy. Bob Murphy is here to talk to us about some of the statements we've been hearing in recent weeks by people like Paul Krugman and Larry Summers about the condition of the economy and the future of the economy. So we're going to talk today about bubbles, we're going to talk about inflation, we're going to talk about business cycles, negative interest rates, and all this crazy stuff that we're hearing from these guys. Now, who is Bob Murphy? A lot of you already know, but he is the author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal, Lessons for the Young Economist, Chaos Theory, and he's also the author of study guides for several Austrian classics, such as Mises' Human Action and Mises' Theory of Money and Credit and Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State. He blogs at Consulting by RPM. RPM are his initials, consultingbyrpm.com. Bob, are you able to explain all this stuff going on here that's coming out of the mouth of Larry Summers?
Yes, exactly.
Now, you have a blog post, and that's what made me think it's time to have Murphy back on here. And you're talking about Paul Krugman's summary of what Larry Summers recently said at the IMF. Now, apparently, Summers is suggesting that insanity is going to be the new normal. Can you unpack this?
Sure. So I think the first thing to make sure your listeners understand is what Krugman means by a liquidity trap.
Right. Explain this.
All right. So the way he discusses it, and you know, this is fairly standard. I mean, other economists would quibble with, you know, basically what the idea is. Is he's saying that normally what happens when the economy slows down, even Keynesians like Krugman ostensibly would say that doesn't call for fiscal action. The central bank has the power to fix it. They just lower interest rates. Because of the lower interest rate, people in the private sector are going to spend more on consumption, spend more on investment. And so you don't need the government to come in and run a budget deficit to fix the economy. Even Krugman says that's his official position, except when you get into a liquidity trap. Because suppose the economy is in such dire straits that aggregate demand is so much falling short of where it needs to be for full employment that the Fed pushes interest rates all the way down so that the nominal level is 0%, and yet there's still a shortfall. You still have high unemployment. And so Krugman's point is obviously at that point, standard monetary policy loses traction because you can't make nominal interest rates go negative. And so that's where now everything that you normally think of as the standard laws of economics get turned upside down because now you're in the liquidity trap. And so here, Krugman says it's where the government wasting money is actually a good thing. That you don't want the government to be penny pinching and balance the budget when there's a liquidity trap on. You want it to waste money. You want the Fed to make people think there's going to be high inflation in the future because then that will make them spend money now. Okay, so the normal sorts of things that you associate with good governance, Krugman says, go out the window when there's a liquidity trap. So throughout this crisis, he's been pushing these policy views, but he always says, hey, I'm not a nut job. Once we get out of this recession and things get back to normal, then I'm going to go back to worrying about the budget deficit. I'm going to agree that savings is a good thing and all that kind of stuff. It's just during this liquidity trap is where things get turned upside down and all of these normal economists who aren't Keynesians are giving horrible advice.
Bob, forgive me. Let me interrupt for just one second. And I realize this is a bit of a tangent, but we should touch on it. I think a lot of times libertarians who read Krugman or are vaguely acquainted with Keynesianism, I think they think the normal Keynesian prescription is just always have deficits or always have always build bridges and then blow them up and then build them again and blow them up again and so on. I think it's important to explain that that's not really the case. But on the other hand, is that really libertarians' fault? Or is there some aspect of Keynesianism that might lead somebody to falsely think that that's what they're saying?
That's a good question. I think it's a little bit of both, that it's certainly true in terms of standard textbook New Keynesian theory that you're not supposed to run a budget deficit just to fix a depressed economy so long as interest rates are positive. That even the standard theory would say, no, that just wastes resources. Go ahead and have the Fed put interest rates or the central bank lower interest rates. But it is true that in practice, I think you won't see that as much, and that also old Keynesianism, I think that was their standard view, that they did like running, they had this thing about you run deficits when there's a recession and then you run surpluses when there's a boom so that you have a balanced budget over the business cycle, that sort of thing. So it's, and also it's very convenient that when there's a Republican in office, that's when Krugman was being very much of a budget hawk in terms of, oh my gosh, these irresponsible tax cuts for the rich, I can't believe it. So, again, it depends how fair you want to be. It's certainly true that you can point to textbook New Keynesian theory, not old Keynesian, but New Keynesian theory that makes these subtle points. But in practice, I think it is true that the people who call themselves Keynesians really do seem like they're always coming up with good reasons why the government ought to be spending money right now.
All right, let's get back to what you're describing now then. As Krugman has been saying, because we're in a liquidity trap, as he says, there are certain laws of economics that don't apply right now, but they will apply once we get out of this. So now how does Larry Summers affect this overall picture?
Okay, so now in that context, at the recent IMF conference, Summers presented this shocking paper or this big deal paper, and Krugman summarizing it on his blog saying, hey, I've been going along these lines myself. Summers came out and just said it point blank that we need to face up to the fact that we may be in this liquidity trap for a long time, that we've been on the verge of falling into it since the 1980s, and the only thing that's kept us out of it has been a series of bubbles. And that, so they're saying the entire nature of the U.S., this is the whole structure of the U.S. economy from the 1980s till now and then for the foreseeable future is such that unless we have a string of bubbles, we're going to fall into the liquidity trap. And so that's, so it's sort of like they warm people up for a few years by saying this is just a very temporary, odd situation where normal policy recommendations and things that seem like prudence are actually a bad idea. But then now they're kind of saying, oh, by the way, this stuff we've been telling you for the last few years, this is going to be the standard going forward. And just to give you an example of what I mean, the next day or two, Krugman had a post talking about Social Security, and he said, it's good if you expand Social Security so that people save less. So he's saying that we need to come up with things that make Americans save less. And he's not talking about next fiscal quarter or something. He's saying, like, in terms of going forward, decades into the future, the problem right now is that people are saving too much. So, he's really taking this to mean this is a long-term structural change now because the U.S. economy as it is addicted to bubbles and then all these policy recommendations flow from that view.
All right, now on Larry Summers, we've got now a subsequent interview that was excerpted over on Zero Hedge that you and I read before we started chatting. He was asked how he felt about bubbles. Well, he says, I don't favor bubbles. But he had been saying we've only been able to have growth because of bubbles, so maybe we need a new framework in which we can have growth without bubbles. But someone like David Stockman has been saying sort of the same thing, right? That what we've been seeing are these bubbles that they bump up the numbers, maybe. They make it look like we've got a lot of employment, we've got a lot of economic activity. But in terms of real economic indicators, it really hasn't been so good for the genuine health of the economy. So it's interesting that both Stockman and Summers would say there's something unnatural about what's been going on here.
Right. That's a great point. I'm glad you made that connection because I was thinking the same thing. That let's just be clear, make sure everyone understands what Summers' nuanced position is. It's sort of like when Krugman is caught now with that infamous line where he said after the dot-com crash that, Alan Greenspan needs to replace the dot-com bubble with the housing bubble. Now he's denying that what he meant by that. But same thing with Summers. He's not saying, oh, it's a good thing we kept having bubble after bubble, and going forward, policymakers need to do whatever they can to encourage a bubble. That's not what he's saying. What he means is, given the way the economy is right now, if policymakers don't take my strong medicine and really totally reform everything along my blueprint, then the only way we avoid the liquidity trap is to have bubbles. And so, you're right, though. It is kind of ironic that, on the one hand, you've got guys like Summers and Krugman who laugh at paranoid nut jobs like guys like Ron Paul and Stockman and Tom Woods and Bob Murphy, who ever since Nixon, you know, closed the gold window, they've been telling us that the economy's been fundamentally screwed up and blah, 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 and they keep warning about how awful that's going to be, but nothing really bad happened. We're, you know, what's the problem, guys?
Right.
And then they're admitting, no, the whole U.S. economy, the very structure of it for decades now, has been dependent on bubbles to avoid a catastrophe.
You would think that would make them, I don't know, apologize. Like, even though we don't agree with our opponents on everything, they did have a basic insight here that things sort of went screwy 40 years ago.
Right, yeah. And so all we're really disagreeing on is how to fix it. But certainly we both, you know, they're now coming over to our point of view and realizing that, yes, something was structurally, fundamentally screwed up with the whole U.S. economy for decades at this point. And, you know, the other thing, too, is, this is sort of a subtle point, but remember, you know, what's the smoking gun that they use against us? And Larry Summers does it in the same interview where, you know, the Zero Hedge people are quoting from, is that he says, you know, clearly these, what he calls austerians, these inflation hawks, have been wrong because they've been warning that QE is going to give us hyperinflation, and they've been wrong. But by his own logic, the reason there hasn't been big inflation over the last few decades is because there was just, you know, bubbles were there, sort of soaking up things and then getting the economy to jump from bubble to bubble. So, and we, you know, it's not that there hasn't been hyperinflation for the last 40 years in the U.S. So by his own acknowledgement, you could have an economy that is seriously screwed up and jumping from bubble to bubble without seeing CPI go through the roof every 4 years. And so why are we so nuts for saying right now that QE is causing another bubble, if that's his own view of what's been going on?
Now, I want to talk about QE in a few minutes, because in this Larry Summers interview, he gives an endorsement of it. I guess there had been something of an urban legend according to which Summers had been an opponent of QE, or he might have been 0.03% more of a hawk than Yellen. But I want to get back to this idea that we're in a liquidity trap, and at this point, we have to discourage saving as best we can. We got to get people, even the government, spending on ridiculous things, because in this case, it makes sense, because all bets are off. The traditional laws of economics don't hold. What do you, as an Austrian economist, say to that? And I know that's a big question, because I'd think your answer would be that the whole framework underlying this way of thinking is all wrong. But what would you say?
Right. That's the main thing, is they're viewing the sole function of interest rates is to be a lever that causes total spending to rise or to fall. And so that, oh my gosh, if there's a shortfall in area of demand, well, you got to lower interest rates to boost spending up. And then, oh shucks, if that doesn't work because when you hit zero, now we got to do some unorthodox thing like promise future inflation or have the government start even, you know, building bridges that don't go anywhere, and that's better than nothing. And so, yeah, one major objection that from an Austrian perspective is you're totally misconstruing what it is that interest rates do, and you're setting the economy up for boom bust cycles by pushing down interest rates whenever the economy slows down. But that's just causing the very problem. The other thing too is that, look, prices can certainly adjust, and part of what's happening is people anticipate that the Fed is going to come in and intervene and do things to prevent dreaded deflation. But I mean, if the Fed just stood back and let the bottom fall on this stuff, yeah, it would be awful for 6 months, but then everybody would adjust to the new situation. They would form their new expectations. You'd hit a legitimate bottom and you'd grow from there. And yeah, a lot of prices would fall, but it's not that tractors would disappear. Farmland wouldn't disappear. Skilled people wouldn't lose their mental abilities just because prices fell. You'd still have the same real economy, and then things would just get rearranged and then you go forward. So, this idea that we're stuck in this decades-long slump now because of some quirk about negative real interest rates, to me, just seems to totally misconstrue what interest rates do and the ability of the market to adjust to a change in growth expectations measured in nominal terms.
I think it's unavoidable in this context to say something about QE, because of this interview of Summers. And as I said, he was asked about QE, and he says that history will look back and overwhelmingly approve the decision to engage in QE. And I don't doubt that, because history tends to be written by people who support the state. So, of course, they're going to support QE. So explain what QE, quantitative easing, explain what QE is. I'm sure we have some listeners who hear this term over and over, and they don't really know what it means. And at this point, they're too embarrassed to say so, because they feel like, well, by now I really should know this, and I really don't. And then secondly, Bob, a lot of times we say quantitative easing is just a synonym for inflation. And then the sophisticates like Krugman come along and say, what's wrong with you people? It's not inflation. It's just an asset swap. Can you clear all this up for us?
Sure. So normally, what if you think about it, before this recession occurred, when the Fed would announce its, what it was going to do after a meeting or something, they would always quantify their decision in terms of what they were going to do with the interest rate. You know, the Fed today announced that it was cutting the Federal Reserve or federal funds rate by 30 basis points or whatever. Like, it was always measured in terms of what are they doing with the interest rate. But once that got pushed so low that they no longer could cut interest rates, that's when they switched to announcing how much money they were pumping into the economy, right? So if you think about it, before this recession, the Fed never told you what they were doing with their balance sheet or how much money, how many assets they were buying. You would never have that information. You have to go look it up yourself. So that's one way of seeing what they mean by quantitative easing. They're telling you the quantity of new money that they're putting in. And then if the various rounds just refer to, they would make a major announcement about this is how much we're going to spend. You know, we're going to make these amount of purchases over this amount of time. And so if you look like at a chart of the, what's called the monetary base of the Federal Reserve, you can see there's three distinct periods where it, you know, it starts zooming up, then it levels off, then it zooms up again, and now we're in the last one, where which is referring to the $85 billion a month in treasuries and mortgage-backed securities that we're still in the midst of. So those are what people mean by the QE 1, 2, and 3. They were distinct announcements about asset purchases that the Fed was going to undertake because, oh, geez, so far it's not working yet. And then as far as Krugman saying it's not inflation, I mean, it in terms of what does the Federal Reserve do, it creates money out of thin air in order to buy new assets and then gives that new money into the financial sector. I mean, it's still the same process. And they can say, well, it's different here because it's not leading to huge increases in prices, and so you guys are crazy, or that, you know, the intent is not just to print money. But I mean, in terms of what are they doing? Yeah, of course they're creating new money and injecting into the financial system.
Now, don't the various waves of QE correspond to certain policy aims? In other words, QE is not the traditional Federal Reserve policy of trying to fine-tune the economy through various injections, and so on, but they had particular aims. QE has particular aims involving the housing market, and QE was intimately connected to these particular aims that they had.
Right. I'm glad you brought that up. And this also, different economists had different things in mind, and it depends. Are you talking about what did the Federal Reserve officials say was the reason for what they were doing, and then what did other people say was, well, yeah, it is working, but not for the reasons they're saying. So it gets really complicated, but yeah, I mean, it's why are they buying mortgage-backed securities? How come they're not buying Google stock, or how come they're not buying land in Thailand or something like that? I mean, in principle, if the point is just to put money into the system, they could be buying all kinds of stuff, but yet they're buying treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. So I would say, well, of course, part of the reason they're buying treasuries is that they're monetizing the federal government's debt. The federal government's running humongous deficits, and they want to make sure that the interest rate on that doesn't get too high and people don't start to suspect that it's unsustainable. So that's one reason. And then, yeah, even the official rationale for why they were buying the mortgage-backed securities was that was going to help contain the panic in the financial system that was hitting, if you remember, in September of 2008, where it was sort of a vicious downward spiral where if all of a sudden people doubted the worth of those assets, well, then the companies holding them all of a sudden were in trouble, and then people, you know, they couldn't get credit and so on. And so the Fed coming in and sort of putting a floor under the price of those mortgage-backed securities was supposed to quell the panic and allow the financial system to recuperate.
Well, do you think that's responsible? Because, of course, that's the Larry Summers / establishment view, that we would have had a depression had it not been for these bold moves by the Fed.
Well, if you think about it, again, it's kind of like we're all saying basically the same thing, but just from diametrically opposed perspectives. I mean, even Ron Paul, if you asked him what would have happened had the government done what you recommended in September of 2008, he would have said, oh, yeah, there would have been an awful depression, but it would have lasted just a few months. So, yeah, those financial firms, I mean, I don't know if he would have used the word depression, but those financial firms holding those assets, they would have all gone under had the Fed not bailed them out by buying those things at what at the time was way above market prices. But the broader question, of course, is, well, was that a good thing to do? I mean, just by the same way, we could say, did Alan Greenspan, when he slashed interest rates after the dot-com bust and gave us the housing bubble, did he buy a few extra years before the real crisis struck? And the answer is, yeah, if he hadn't done anything and just sat back and let it implode, things might have been worse in 2003 than they seemed at people actually in 2003. But he didn't really do the economy any favors. He just made the situation fester and made it that much worse. So I think it's the same thing here that, yeah, it is a true statement to say, had Bernanke not done QE, things might have been really, really bad in the summer of 2009. Whereas, in contrast, it seemed like, oh, I guess things aren't so bad after all. That's just because he was masking the problem and letting it fester.
Bob, let me read you a brief statement by Summers and get your reaction to it. He says this: what caused this crisis is that there was overconfidence and complacency, excessive borrowing and lending, and unsustainable spending. That is what caused this crisis. But now, after the crisis, the only way we will get the economy back to normal is if we have more confidence, more borrowing and lending, and more spending. Now, what would you say to that?
I picked up on that, too. It's hilarious that, I mean, of course, he's literally saying what we need to do right now is the exact same thing that caused the current mess, which is what Austrians have been saying, but yet he doesn't even seem to realize the irony. At least somebody like Krugman kind of acknowledges, yeah, I realize this sounds crazy, but it's true.
Yeah, now, Bob, I'm glad that you're noticing this, because I was thinking that maybe it's because I don't have a PhD in economics, my PhD is in history, that maybe I'm missing some sophisticated subtlety here, but I'm glad to learn that I'm not.
Right. So he doesn't even go out of his way in that particular quote. Maybe he does it elsewhere, but he doesn't acknowledge the apparent problem there and then explain why. Yeah, just because I'm recommending the very thing that I admit got us into this crisis, this time it's going to be a good thing. He doesn't even give a nod to that and explain it, so it's hard for me even to get into his head. If I could just very quickly go back, the reason people were saying that Yellen is better than Summers is he actually, perhaps in an unguarded moment, did write something along the lines of, I am not sure that further QE would do anything, because right now, with interest rates so low, if there are projects people aren't investing in an undertaking at this kind of a low rate of return, I mean, to push the interest rates even further negative, and then that makes the project profitable, are we sure we want to be pushing people into those projects? So it was almost an Austrian-esque point. But that was because he said he had the temerity to say that. That's when all the progressives bit his head off, and like guys like, I think it was Iglesias, accused him of being a socialist, because he, in other words, Larry Summers was trying to micromanage and doubt what the market was going to do, because, you know, Larry Summers knew that a project that could only be profitable at negative 2% interest rate was not a good project. But that was the spin they gave to it and bit his head off, because he suggested maybe we don't want to encourage investment in projects that require an even more negative interest rate to be profitable.
Bob, if this is going to become the conventional wisdom, which it very well could, the Summers/Krugman approach here, what kind of things can people expect? Now, the politicians don't necessarily follow the economists all the time, it's true, but they usually follow them in the worst things that they say. So how is this going to affect the average person? And also, how do you respond to the argument, we have huge scope for monetary inflation because prices are so darn low, so we can afford to do crazy things?
Well, as far as your first question about what does this mean, I think what guys like Krugman and Summers and other sort of intellectual pundits, by which I mean people who don't have PhDs, but guys like Iglesias and Ezra Klein and those kind of guys, what they do is they come up with a seemingly intellectually justified rationale for what the government wants to do. So we can't predict exactly what direction the government's going to move in, but the point is, if they want to go a certain way now, they can cite this stuff, try to explain it, and it percolates up into the more responsible policymaker views. So you can see stuff coming out of the Federal Reserve or the IMF or World Bank or what have you. And so I think that's kind of what this is, that guys like Krugman and Summers are the people who throw it out there and run up the flagpole, and then people can see if it's going to stick. As far as people saying, oh, come on, prices haven't been blowing up, so we can afford to keep pushing this until we see some negative consequences. Well, again, it's sort of odd that even Summers and Krugman are agreeing that this sort of mentality has just been getting us bouncing from bubble to bubble for decades now. And so isn't that one of the negative consequences?
Right, that good. Thank you.
Yeah, that is, what part of what we've been saying, and it's true. I mean, it was, I guess, a tactical mistake, and I, of course, am guilty of this, that I thought price inflation was going to be worse by now than it has been. But certainly the Austrian theory of the business cycle, the objection that Mises and Hayek made to monetary and credit inflation was not, oh, that might make prices at the grocery store go up higher than the housewives would want. That was never the issue. The issue was it's going to set up a boom-bust cycle and interest rates serve a purpose, and so if you change them, you're going to screw things up. So all of that is still true. The one last thing, though, is to the extent that they do keep piling money in, at some point, they're going to have to unwind that stuff. I mean, at some point, prices will start rising, and banks, when they feel confident again, are going to start lending, and so it's better to not have $10 trillion in excess reserves sitting there. It'd be better to have just $1 trillion. So the point is, even if you didn't think there was an issue, if everybody's kind of agreeing this isn't really working right now, it's not getting us where we need to be, then why would you just keep piling on?
You know, new people are subscribing to this program all the time, and although a lot of people know about the Austrian theory of the business cycle, or they hear the term boom-bust cycle and they know what we're talking about, we probably should have a program for the average guy who's just diving into this for the first time and have it be on Austrian business cycle theory. So maybe we'll have you or some other guest, because it really is the key to understanding so many other things. Well, anyway, Bob, as always, I appreciate your time. There's always so much idiocy to respond to, and yet I have Bob Murphy only twice a month. But I think we really packed a lot of good responses into this short amount of time. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me. See if you can get Larry Summers on, and he can talk about Austrian business cycle theory.
That's right. Or Krugman seems to know it so intimately, right?
Yeah.
All right, thanks again.
Thanks.
All right, that's it for the program for today. Ladies and gentlemen, no program tomorrow. Enjoy your Thanksgiving, but we will be back on Friday with a special Black Friday offer for you guys, plus ex-CIA man Phil Giraldi talking foreign policy, non-intervention, Ron Paul, etc. Don't forget, you can help this program on Black Friday and every day of the year when you're about to make a purchase at Amazon. Go over to TomWoodsRadio.com and enter Amazon from our widget there. And at no cost to you, you can help us pay the bills here in our little Tom Woods office where I'm able to make these programs for you guys. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. See you Friday.
The Tom Woods Show.